Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 11th day of July, 2020. I'm your host, Mark Call, and let's take a look back at some of the major events, certainly not all of them, because you've no doubt heard about those, that transpired during the week where Americans realized, this may have been the last actual Independence Day that we'll celebrate. In no small part because, sadly, most of them are ignorant of what actually transpired back in 1776 anyway. And by and large, the good news is that it was a lot more peaceful than it could have been, with the obvious exception of some of the leftist cesspool cities. In gun-free, Bill of Rights-free Chicago, for example, at least 70 people were shot and 14 were pronounced dead by Sunday night over the weekend there, where no doubt the mayor and most of her staff don't know what the celebration would have been about anyway. And the death toll kind of depends on which of the two leftist papers you're looking at. The Chicago Sun-Times reported 74 people shot, 14 fatally, by 6:45 p.m. Central Time on the 5th of July, while the Chicago Tribune reported 80 shot, 17 fatally. In gun-free New York, though, even before the weekend, Breitbart News reported that more than 110 people had been shot in New York City over a 9-day period in 83 separate shootings. And the NYPD is officially looking for a man who opened fire on two innocent people on July 3rd, killing one on video. There were some very visible protests, even warnings, over the weekend, although so far at least there haven't been widespread reports of violence. One heavily armed, mostly black group, known as the NFAC, which stands for the somewhat obscene Not F***ing Around Coalition, marched through Stone Mountain Park near Atlanta on Independence Day and attempted to call out white militias, saying through a loudspeaker, "We're here, where the fuck you at? We're in your house, let's go," reported Reuters. But as the spokesman for the Stone Mountain Memorial Association pointed out, NFAC's demonstration was, in fact, peaceful. Quote, "It's a public park, a state park. We have these protests on both sides of the issue from time to time. We respect people's First Amendment right," he told WXIA-TV, "and that, of course, puts them in a class by themselves. We understand," he continued, "the sensitivities of the issue here at the park, so we respect that and allow them to come in as long as it's peaceful, which it has been," unquote. There was, of course, more monument idiocy over the weekend. As Summit News' Paul Joseph Watson pointed out, a statue of Frederick Douglass, the famous black anti-slavery activist, was actually torn down, presumably by those protesting against racism, who seemed to be woefully ignorant of history in general, but racism in particular, in Rochester, New York. The statue of the black social reformer who escaped from slavery in Maryland and went on to become a national leader of the abolitionist movement in Massachusetts and New York, and who was noted for his outstanding speeches and anti-slavery writings, was removed from its base and hauled about 50 feet, heavily damaged. As Zero Hedge noted, if the ignorant protesters had simply spent 2 minutes even on Wikipedia, they could have confirmed who it was they were tearing down, but the facts don't seem to matter anymore. For his part, the president tweeted his disgust, saying, quote, "This shows that these anarchists have no bounds." And here next is a story that I'll do, even though it really isn't in the least surprising. In a video produced by Campus Reform, writes Watson in another story, young Americans displayed the, now typical, complete lack of knowledge about the holiday that takes place on the 4th of July, actually referred to as Independence Day. When asked about the holiday and what it commemorates and other details concerning the Declaration of Independence, most of those interviewed were literally clueless. Some guessed that the U.S. may have gained independence after the Civil War, World War I, or in some cases even World War II, but I don't think they know the difference there either. Others complained that the real history of America isn't being taught in schools, perhaps because it's what they know as opposed to what really happened. But the irony here is that that may be about the only thing that most of these ignorant, no longer really Americans, actually got right. But in fairness, though, I do have to admit this. It looks like the interviews took place on California campuses. So hopefully there are at least a few places left in America, with a C, actually, where the history hasn't yet been subjected to Orwell's Ministry of Truth and being expunged completely, like what the Doublethink crowd is trying to do to monuments. Still, though, maybe that's better than what Nike is pushing. Their spokes nutcase, Colin Kaepernick, on his Independence Day message said, quote, "We reject your celebration of white supremacy." I guess all I can add to that is if I had a set of Nike sneakers, and I wouldn't encourage anybody to actually ever go buy any again, I'd much rather see them burned than the American flag. There may be at least a bit more good news from the left coast as well. This is kind of an interesting story. Makes you wonder about what's really going on behind the scenes. Is it possible, just maybe, that some of the remaining historically literate Southern Californians have had enough? But Saturday evening, says a piece from Breitbart, a KCAL helicopter caught people in Los Angeles defying local anti-Independence Day ordinances with actual celebrations via fireworks. All around the sky, noted the helicopter crew, fireworks lit up the night. Even though a KCAL announcer warned that violators could be fined up to $50,000. Christina Layla of the Gateway Pundit's coverage of the same story says that July festivities lit up the sky with thousands of illegal fireworks, perhaps because socialist tyrant Governor Gavin Newsom and other officials had shut down 4th of July festivities in California due to the so-called surge in coronavirus cases. As you probably know, from bars to restaurants and beaches to museums, Newsom shut down about everything except for his own winery in Napa Valley. And as a result, it seems, Californians revolted and celebrated anyway by lighting up the sky with thousands of illegal fireworks. I can't help but hope that people who've gotten sick and tired of seeing looters and muggers get away with it, calling it a protest, might be having a protest of their own. Here's one that may or may not be good news, but it's certainly unusual. In a rare unanimous decision from the United States Supreme Court, the 9 black-robed priests of another god, the justices in other words, ruled unanimously that states can require presidential electors to back their state's popular vote winner in the Electoral College. The ruling arose out of a case from Washington State, where else, which essentially gives states the right to outlaw so-called faithless voters who cast their votes for people other than those chosen by the voters of the state. The general idea is that electors are pledged to vote for the candidate that they're supposed to vote for. I can certainly understand those who might say, hey, we have senators and representatives and governors and presidents who put their hand on a Bible and pledge to do something they have no intention of doing. What's the difference? The problem there seems to boil down to we've now got an entire society that doesn't honor its word. But in this case, the unanimous ruling of the court says that states can require presidential electors to honor their pledges and back their state's popular vote winner in the Electoral College. The decision, says the story, comes just 4 months before the 2020 election, and it leaves in place laws in 32 states and the District of Criminals that bind electors to vote for the popular vote winner in the individual state, and electors almost always do so anyway. But here's the bigger problem, folks, that seems to remain unaffected by this court decision. As you may be aware, there are a number of states that are now trying openly to violate a number of articles of the Constitution in an attempt to complete their Bolshevik revolution. There is a movement afoot to actually get states to try to enter into a treaty, which, by the way, is explicitly forbidden by Article 1, Section 10, Paragraph 1 of the Constitution. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, and that's exactly what they're trying to do, with the idea of saying all of this state's electoral votes will go to the national popular vote winner. In other words, it's an end run around the entire concept of what the Electoral College was set up to avoid. And that battle, at least, isn't yet over. From there, since most of the nation at least was taking a break over the last few days, let's recap some of the major stories up to the holiday weekend. Starting with the massive and continuing CDC fraud being used to dupe people into trading essential liberty for a little temporary security, courtesy of the Gateway Pundit and Joe Hoft, which begins by noting that back in May of 2020, even the far-left Atlantic was pointing out how the CDC was fudging the figures. Basically, what they were doing was calling anything that looked like a coronavirus the dreaded booga 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 version, and we know that even common colds fall in that category, so hey, that's probably a whole lot of extra cases. They could be called false positives, but think about it, folks. If you don't know what they really have, and you just count them using a bogus test, how many are actually false positives? How many are real? And how are you ever going to know? Said the Atlantic, the Centers for Disease Control and Provocation is conflating the results of two different types of coronavirus tests, distorting several important metrics, and providing the country with an inaccurate picture of the state of the plandemic. We've learned, said the Atlantic, that the CDC is making, at best, a debilitating mistake, combining test results that diagnose current coronavirus infections with test results that measure whether or not someone has ever had the virus. And that's even another degree of conflict. inflation. The upshot is that the government's disease-fighting agency, yeah, sure, is overstating the country's ability to test people who are sick with COVID-1984. And the agency even confirmed to The Atlantic that they're mixing the results of both viral and antibody tests, even though the two tests reveal different information and are used for different reasons. And this, they said, is not merely a technical error, because states have set quantitative guidelines for returning to a semblance of constitutional government and allowing a once-free people to return to free enterprise. That's not how they put it, of course, because they don't care about that. So, in summary, by including both active cases with cases of individuals who had the China coronavirus in the past, the CDC is grossly overstating the number of active cases in the U.S. And unfortunately, notes Hoft, states like Texas and Florida have reset their economic reopening timetables based on this bogus data. But wait, there's more, because the CDC is still at it. Forbes reported last week that the GAO, too, has come out and levied criticism at the CDC for their bogus methodology. And even the New York Times deigned to report on that. Says Hoft, in conclusion, the CDC's method of reporting the number of active cases is totally flawed. Well, beyond that, it's fraudulent. And this data is being used by states to determine whether or not they're going to pay attention to the Constitution and reopen their economies. You do have to ask the question, is there anything about this COVID-1984 data that is valid and accurate? But it certainly serves the purpose if your intention is to burn it all down. Speaking of which, oh yeah, corruption run amok, and California may be the worst example in the nation. Communist Governor of California Gavin Newsom has announced that, yeah, any excuse will do, he is rolling back any so-called reopening of the People's Republic due to the surge in coronavirus cases. And now do you see again why those bogus inflated numbers are so important to the far left in the Bolshevik Revolution? Quote, tomorrow we'll be making some additional announcements on efforts to use the dimmer switch that we've referred to and begin to toggle back on our stay-at-home order and tighten things up, said the Fuhrer. The framework for us is this. If you're not going to stay home and you're not going to wear masks in public, you little slaves, you, we have to enforce. Und wir will, and we'll be making announcements on enforcement tomorrow. And you ready for this? As Christine Layla puts it for the Gateway Pundit, Newsom's biggest concern is family gatherings for the verboten 4th of July. Not the BLM riots or anything like that. No, he's concerned that people might actually remember what freedom was once about in America and how a bunch of people unanimously pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to fight tyrants that admittedly don't even begin to compete with this scumbag. Why, people who think they're free might actually go to a barbecue and take off their masks. As she puts it, how the hell is any of this Newsom's business or concern? Answer, it wouldn't be if we still had a free country and our founding fathers fought and died for a lot less. Said the Fuhrer, quote, I cannot say it enough. I said it last week, I said it yesterday, and I'll say it again. We've got 4th of July weekend coming up. One of the areas of biggest concern relates to the spread of COVID-19 in the state, and it remains family gatherings. No, not just bars, not just being out in the streets where people are protesting and the like, said the commie. It's specifically family gatherings, where family members, or rather households, immediate and extended family members, begin to mix and take down their guard. They may walk into that barbecue with masks on, and when they put the cooler down, the mask comes off. They have a glass of water, and all of a sudden, nieces and nephews start congregating, unquote. Und wir will stamp it out. As Layla puts it correctly, this is pure Marxism. Black Lives Matter terrorists are allowed to do whatever they want, but law-abiding citizens, at least in the People's Republic of California, must obey Newsom's authoritarian, unconstitutional lockdown orders. But by the time the week was over, Bill de Blasio, the communist mayor of New York, had upped the ante and tried to do him one better, basically declaring that there would be no large gatherings allowed whatsoever. Well, unless you're talking about Black Lives Matter and planning on a little rioting and looting. Can you see that there's a problem here, folks? Especially on a weekend when some of us still remember that freedom was worth fighting for and that honest government had just powers based on the consent of the governed. No wonder these evil people are so intent on destroying even the idea of the Declaration of Independence. And sadly, that now seems to include even the U.S. military. Dateline Washington, D.C., courtesy of LifeSite News and Doug Mainwaring. The U.S. Navy is facing backlash after issuing a directive banning personnel from attending off-base religious services due to a recent uptick in those bogus numbers surrounding the COVID-1984 cases, while instead they're greenlighting participation in everything from protests to parties. But we can't have that God of the Bible reminding people about what this nation once thought were self-evident truths. Quote, in open defiance of the commander-in-chief, who recently declared churches essential to America, the U.S. Navy has threatened to court-martial service members if they go to church, said Mike Berry, First Liberty Institute General Counsel, an organization dedicated to defending religious freedom, and who is representing Major Daniel Schultz on that front. It's absolutely outrageous, said Berry in a statement, that our troops can't go to church, but they can attend a protest or host house parties of any size. The First Liberty statement explains that the Navy's orders apply to everyone assigned to Navy units and vessels, including, ironically, its chaplains. Sailors returning from duty are not permitted to leave their ship until they agree to abide by official U.S. Navy orders preventing them from attending, quote, indoor religious services. And those who fail to abide by the Navy's orders may be prosecuted via court-martial. Said Chaplain Colonel Ron Cruz, U.S. Army retired and executive director of the Chaplain Alliance for Religious Liberty, quote, we're stunned that the Navy would issue this unlawful order. Our chaplains have fought, bled, and even died for the right of every service member to enjoy religious freedom wherever they are, at home and abroad, he told Fox News. For the Navy to strip away that freedom in this manner is unconscionable. LifeSite News says that as of press time, neither the Secretary of the Navy nor the Joint Chiefs had responded to their inquiry. And let's not forget that in post-First Amendment America, especially in places like California, people who are allowed to go to church by Big Brother might not be allowed to sing. Of course, it's kind of hard with a muzzle on anyway. And the mask insanity, of course, may be the biggest story not only the week, but the year, maybe the century. You know, folks, as I was doing this story, I kept trying to think of historic parallels. Some are obvious, but they're not perfect. For example, the brown shirts, Kristallnacht, all kinds of things that happened in Nazi Germany, just like we're seeing in wannabe Nazi America, to divide people and persecute the undesirables. Start by destroying their businesses and take away everything they have and drive the entire nation into a reign of terror. Yes, the Jews had to wear the yellow stars. But if you think about it, that's kind of the opposite of today's sheeple muzzle. The persecuted minority were the ones that they forced to wear some stupid symbol so they could be subjugated. But in this case, you've got a whole nation of sheeple demanding to wear the symbol of their own enslavement, their own willingness to drink the Kool-Aid, and of course demanding that everybody else be a Kool-Aid drinker too. That, at least, is consistent. Who would have thought, folks, that the real final straw in America's Civil War 2.0, the reason why a few people would finally decide, I've had enough, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, might be something as demonstrably asinine, of absolutely no value whatsoever, as a placebo mask? Well, here we are. From Dr. Ron Paul, via Lou Rockwell and the Ron Paul Institute, the Texas COVID spike, he writes, is a fraud. And while that's certainly clear, it's nice to have somebody of his integrity and gravitas to point it out. On July 2nd, writes the former congressman, Texas Governor Greg Abbott issued an executive order mandating the wearing of face masks, useless though they may be, except as a barometer, across the state, whether indoors or outdoors, when 6 feet cannot be maintained between people. In the governor's decree, he cited a rise in COVID cases, a rise in test positivity, and a rise in hospitalizations as justification to force people to cover their faces in public, like good little slaves. The move is not only a violation of the civil liberties of all Texans, but Abbott may have based his executive order, writes Dr. Paul, on inaccurate information about the so-called rise in COVID cases due to the Texas State Department of Health Services changing the definition of what constitutes a COVID case. Thanks, he writes, goes to Collin County Judge Chris Hill for blowing the whistle on what appears to be a move back in mid-May to redefine what was a COVID case in order to open the door to a massive increase, all to match the waystream media line that a booga 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 second wave was on the way. In the commissioner's court hearing for Collin County on May 18th, it was revealed that while previously the determination of a COVID case, as it was called, was a confirmed test result, the definition was suddenly changed to count probable cases as cases. And if we don't tell people the difference, what? They'll drink the Kool-Aid, put on their masks, and go to the slaughter like good little slaves. And at the same time, he continues, the threshold for determining probable was lowered to a ridiculous level. As Judge Hill said at that May 18th meeting, if you have a subjective fever and you have a headache and you live in Collin County, you now meet the qualifications to be a probable COVID patient. It is remarkable, he continued, how low the standard is now. But even worse, writes Dr. Paul, once a probable case was determined based on possibly unrelated but still subjective criteria, up to 15 people in possible contact with that probable case were also listed as probable cases, which of course means they are cases. Repeat that farce all across Texas, he concludes, and it's no wonder that there was a spike in what they laughably call cases. But remember, folks, the goal has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with your health. It has to do with your enslavement. And if you doubt that, just wait and see what's coming when it comes to food availability and, of course, prices. As the far left continues to try to shut the economy down again and basically put a final wooden stake into it, we should do a meltdown update next. And we'll start this one off with one of those signs of the times stories, courtesy of Zero Hedge and Tyler Durden. Brooks Brothers, the oldest U.S. men's retailer, has now filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Part of the problem may be that the forced work-from-home lockdown, says the piece, have created an environment where the average working man or woman or whatever in America is now only visible from the shoulder up via the Internet. And this new COVID normal of informal meetings seems to have been just the last nail in the coffin of America's most iconic menswear retailer. Brooks Brothers has just filed for bankruptcy, and that was only weeks after men's warehouse owner Tailored Brands at least considered doing the same. And this latest filing follows other retailers who happen to sell men's workwear, or at least once did, including JCPenney, Neiman Marcus, and J. Crew, who've all filed for bankruptcy since the beginning of the pandemic and the implosion of the U.S. economy. But there's more, because as the week went on, the retail apocalypse accelerated. Courtesy of the Monetary Metals blog via Zero Hedge, 8,700 stores are now closing, with that number set to rise. The unprecedented implosion of U.S. commercial real estate during the coronavirus pandemic is likely to get worse, they say, as newly delinquent CMBS loans are surging and the list of retail store closures continues to rise. TREP's June CMBS remittance report showed commercial mortgage-backed securities delinquencies had hit a high of 10.3%, not seen since 2012, and it was noted that retail CMBS loans were in rough shape. Many retail shops are indeed heavily indebted. Some have already declared bankruptcy, while others are quickly shrinking their operating size by reducing store footprint to rein in their costs during the pandemic-induced recession. No, folks, it's a depression. Let's not kid ourselves. Blended with a plunge in consumption, along with a shift to online purchases, and it's all resulting in a rapid acceleration of the retail apocalypse. CoreSite researchers says in their latest forecast that upwards of 25,000 retail stores could be closed by year-end. And Forbes has updated their closure list, too. And here are just a few of the many names on the list. Chuck E. Cheese's is bankrupt, 54 stores. So is Destination Maternity, GNC, with 1,200 stores. J. Crew, with 54. J.C. Penney, 154 stores. Kmart, with their 45. Modell's Sporting Goods, 153 stores. Neiman Marcus, Last Call, 20 stores. 254 stores for Papyrus. Sears, 51 stores. Signet Jewelers, 232 stores. 738 Stage stores. And Tuesday Mornings, 230 stores. Other big-name closures include AT&T, 250 gone. Bath & Body Works and Bed Bath & Beyond, with about four dozen each. Bloomingdale's, it's just one, but it's a big one you may have heard of. Bose, 11 stores. CVS Pharmacy, 22. The GameStop, 320 stores, Hallmark, 16 stores, Lord & Taylor, somewhere between 30 and 40, Macy's, 125, Microshaft, 77, Nordstrom's, 16, Office Depot, 90, Olympia Sports, 76, Starbucks, 400, Victoria's Secret, 250, and Walgreens, down 100. Already, concludes this piece, 3 million jobs have been eliminated from the economy, many of them from the closure of retail stores. And the bad news about permanent job loss is that it's a consumption killer, resulting in a bit of a feedback loop. Less spending at retailers, suggesting an even greater amount of store closures beyond most people's wildest dreams not too long ago. You're Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. I'm your host, Mark Call, and we're talking about some of the things that are going on. Again, call them signs of the time, in a time when the Constitutional Republic is clearly facing the greatest threat to its existence in its history. I'll start this segment off with at least two brief stories that just help to outline the depth of the swamp. Like this story earlier in the week from the UK Daily Mail. Ghislaine Maxwell has copies of everything Epstein had, including a secret stash, says the story, of the pedophile's sex tapes that could implicate the world's most powerful, and hey, here's a shocker, she will try to use them to save herself. When officials raided Epstein's New York City townhouse last July, they found thousands of graphic photos that included images of underage girls and a safe filled with compact discs labeled nude girls, according to authorities. Anne said the ex-friend, not only did Epstein like to capture himself with underage girls, he wanted to make sure he had something to hold over the world's rich and powerful men who took advantage of his sick largesse. Obviously, it's been called an insurance policy, and the point is, as one of the former friends put it, if Ghislaine goes down, she's going to take the whole damn lot of them with her, unquote. And all I can add to that is, we'll see. At least so far, she has not yet been Arkansided in whatever jail they're holding her. Who knows, though, whether the cameras are working or not. I'm going to call this one a related story. Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, perhaps the most prominent victim of the Russia-Russia-Russiagate special counsel, SIC, Robert Mueller's witch hunt, has co-signed a letter to President Trump, urging him, when it comes to the other people who are victims of the deep state coup, to either pardon or commute the sentence of longtime Trump advisor and friend Roger Stone, who's currently appealing his conviction on charges of lying to Congress. And hey, come on, who are we kidding? It's not like they don't put their hand on a Bible and lie all the time, that were put together by Mueller henchman Andrew Weissman. For his part, General Flynn is still waiting for the corrupt so-called Judge Emmett Sullivan to actually obey the order of the D.C. Court of Appeals to dismiss the bogus case against him, after it's been revealed that prosecutors lied, withheld explosive exculpatory materials from Flynn's lawyers, and after declassified material showed that the entrapment of Flynn was in fact a political setup. Here's what the guy who knows what it's like to be the victim of a political hit job wrote to the president. I urgently and respectfully urge you to use your extraordinary powers of clemency to either commute the sentence of or pardon Roger Stone. I note that the people who engineered his politically motivated prosecution are the same people who engineered a prosecution against me on the basis of entirely fabricated charges and who tried to illegitimately end your presidency twice. The letter was co-signed by a whole lot of other high-profile movers and shakers, and Flynn notes that Stone has been ordered to surrender to a prison in Georgia on July 14th of this year, which just about everyone who's been paying attention realizes is almost certainly a death sentence, unless the president does something fast. And I guess since we're on the topic of railroad jobs and people that the president should but hasn't pardoned, still talking about the same guy, this time from left-leaning Politico, Roger Stone was booted from Instagram on Wednesday after Two-Facebook also decided to get rid of him, determining that he participated in an effort to spread what they call inauthentic information, especially when it comes to his own criminal trial, where arguably he knows a lot more about what's going on than their politically correct fact-checkers. Notes Newsmax, Facebook moved against Stone the same day it took down accounts tied to employees of the family of Brazilian leader Jair Bolsonaro and other networks connected to domestic political operations in Ecuador and the Ukraine. And here, folks, is the real thigh slapper in this one. The socialist media platform said that Stone and his associates, including a prominent supporter of the right-wing Proud Boys group in Stone's home state of Florida, had used fake accounts and followers to promote Stone's books and posts. Who do they think they are? Facebook? And listen to this. Nathaniel Gleicher, Facebook's head of cybersecurity policy, said that the removals were meant to show that artificially inflating engagements for political impact would be stopped, no matter how well-connected the practitioners. Well, of course, unless you're to Facebook itself, which seems to have made this their business model. What a bunch of noxious, stinking hypocrites. And I guess on that note, I might as well get this story out of the way. Call it coup attempt phase 4, or is it 7, or I don't know. I think most of us have lost track. Regardless, the 9 black robe priests of another god are at it again. Let's start with Reuters. The U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday ruled that a New York prosecutor can obtain President Donald Trump's financial records, but prevented, at least for now, the Socialist House of Representatives committees from getting similar documents. Both 7-2 rulings were authored by, and they say it, I'm not gonna, because the one thing he clearly isn't is conservative. Blackmailable, though, he may be. By the way, did you hear the belated stories about how John Roberts somehow or other managed to get his face all bloodied up several weeks ago? They didn't talk about it then. It's just now come out because witnesses have said he looked pretty bad. His face was very bloodied up and he had to go to the hospital where they kept him overnight, and then said, oh, it's because he fell. Well, gee, your increasingly, especially of late, cynical host can't help but remember terms like appearance of impropriety, sniff of corruption, and lots of similar legal terminology that boils down to, if it really truly looks like somebody is corrupt to the core, even if maybe they're not, or like they're being blackmailed, or they're on the take, or maybe all of the above, that's enough to suggest that there's something wrong. And I'm going to suggest, oh, there's something very, very wrong indeed. It's almost like the Supreme Court is vying for the title of most corrupt U.S. institution and giving the FBI and NSA and IRS and BATF, a run for their money. Back to the story. Of the 272 rulings, one of them means that the subpoena issued to Trump's long-term accounting firm, Mazars LLP, for various financial records to be turned over to a grand jury in New York as part of a criminal investigation can be enforced. But they say the court sidestepped a major ruling on whether three House committees could also get their hands on Trump financial documents under subpoena, giving Trump at least a partial short-term win. Notably, the prosecutor and the House committees all issued subpoenas to third parties for the records, but not to the president himself. The AP story leads off by noting that the court issued that mixed verdict Thursday on demands for Trump's financial records, but that they will keep his tax returns, banking, and other documents out of the public eye for the time being. The court, they say, rejected broad arguments by Trump's lawyers and the Just Us Department that the president is immune from investigation while he holds office, or that a prosecutor must show a greater need than normal to obtain the records. And of course, since they want to destroy the president and overturn what's left of the Republican form of government, I guess that does constitute a greater need than normal. Mostly Socialist News called it a stunning defeat for Mr. Trump. The CNBC headline claimed that Trump rages at Supreme Court over tax record case, claims political prosecution. The WAPO headlined a similar claim. One of the president's tweets said the following, quote, "This is all a political prosecution. I won the Mueller witch hunt and others, and now I have to keep fighting in a politically corrupt New York. Not fair to this presidency or administration. Courts in the past have given broad deference," he puts it in quotes, "but not me." Unquote. And even the AP notes that the rejection of Trump's claims of presidential immunity marked the latest instance where Trump's assertion of executive power has been rejected. And they don't say it, but I will, pretty much unlike so many of his predecessors, especially the Obamasiah. Presidential candidate Creepy Joe Biden, says the WAPO, used the occasion to taunt Trump. Trouble is, he couldn't elaborate on exactly why.
Go, you know the thing.
Probably the most cogent comments that I've seen so far, though, have come from Mark Levin, who blasted the decision and warned the SCOTUS judges that Congress can now subpoena their tax returns. Now, wait a minute. He didn't say it. But remember, this case had to do with the state of New York. I might suggest that the prosecutor for the state of Louisiana and or Texas, given their recent abortion abuse, take a look at the black-robed blackmailee John Roberts' financial records. Continued Mark Levin, "I can see a situation in which the House or the Senate decides that it must have access to all of the justices' tax and financial records each year to determine if they're being influenced in any way to write the decisions they write or vote the way they vote on numerous cases." And I guess maybe he's thinking, like most of us are, at a minimum about, yeah, that guy, John Roberts. And furthermore, he said, "The justices will not be able to argue that they are immune as a matter of separation of powers, as they just shot down that argument when it applies to the president." Now, let me pause here and note, hey, nobody but nobody is claiming that these sold-out hypocrites are even remotely consistent. Fine for thee, don't apply to me. Can you smell a rat, folks? Arguably, by now, the only ones that probably can't are those that are breathing their own exhaust fumes through their slave ID facial muzzle. Which reminds me, I made contact yesterday with a very interesting fellow by the name of Damani Felder, who produced a video that's really one of the most outrageously funny that I've seen in a long time, in the form of a spoof ad for a product he suggests is sweeping America, whether we like it or not. He's been kind enough to give me permission to include it here, so I will, along with the proviso that I'd suggest you take a look at the video itself and check out his social media sites.
Do you hate America? Are you sick and tired of having freedoms? Do you wish the government would just tell you what to do every second of the day? Well, now your wish is granted with our brand new authoritarian fashion accessory. Introducing the Slave Muzzle. The Slave Muzzle, made in China, of course, is a revolutionary accessory that not only allows you to virtue signal and feel important 24/7, but also show how willing you are to be a slave to your own government. Originally touted by Dr. Fauci, who first said you didn't need one, the Slave Muzzle says, "Look at me. I'm a sheep. I believe everything I hear on CNN and do whatever I see everyone else doing. Just listen to this real testimonial." Wow, amazing. The Slave Muzzle will cover your nose and mouth while doing a perfect job of symbolically showing the world you can be silenced easily and without any resistance. You may notice the box itself says it's not effective against COVID-19. Please ignore this and strap on your Slave Muzzle immediately. Your unquestioning compliance is appreciated. Why be free when you can be a slave? Do your duty and order your Slave Muzzle today. Show the world you're gullible, proud of it, and don't mind being on your knees forever.
Wow, and I have to admit, the first time I heard that, I remember thinking, this is exactly what I wish I had done. Because it really is a great way to remind those that actually have been drinking the Kool-Aid what they're actually signing up for. But if we really want a good glimpse at what's coming to formerly free America, let's look towards the Far East and Hong Kong, where a related piece from the same source says that things in Hong Kong have rapidly gone straight George Orwell very quickly after the July 1st enactment of their new national security law. Not only are activists there busy scrubbing their digital footprints because they know that the equivalent of Two Facebook and Gulag are going to try to come and get them, and that includes deleting socialist media profiles and chat histories, authorities now can reportedly pry citizens' online communications from internet companies without a warrant. Who could have thought it? Under the new law. But it's not just college age and professional demonstrators. Real protesters, folks, that are actually interested in freedom, and pro-independence organizers that have to worry, because now even schools have been ordered to review textual content in books. Yeah, can you say Fahrenheit 451? Meaning teachers and young students are coming under threat if they don't visibly and positively conform. I wonder if just putting on a mask will be enough to show that they're good little slaves. Hong Kong's Educational Bureau, SIC, this week announced that schools must review their own long-in-use educational material, including books in classrooms and on the library shelves, to ensure that no content which violates the law is allowed to be present. And the Bureau described this as part of an initiative to, quote, positively teach students what the new law is, said the Bureau, in accordance with the four types of offenses clearly stipulated in the law. The school management and teachers should review teaching and learning materials in a timely manner, including books, if they find outdated content or content that may concern the aforementioned offenses. They must be removed. Kind of like Nazi Germany in the 1930s and their book burnings. And in a chilling statement that the story says seems right out of a dystopian novel, the Education Bureau added, "As with other serious crimes or immoral behavior, that is not socially acceptable. Materials should be removed and reselected." Notes AFP, Hong Kong has some of Asia's best universities, or had anyway, and a campus culture where topics that would be taboo on the Chinese communist mainland are still discussed and written about. But disturbingly, Beijing has made it clear that it wants re-education in the city to become more patriotic. Yeah, you know what that means, folks. And if you don't, ask the communist mayors of Chicago or New York. And now, as an even more ominous indicator, for the first time since Hong Kong reached its semi-autonomous status, a new Beijing security office has been opened in the city, and intelligence agents are there for the first time. What do you bet that Gavin Newsom is literally wetting his pants with delight? This next piece comes from one of America's foremost scholars and researchers, Professor John Lott, author of, among many other things, the book More Guns, Less Crime, in fact, the definitive work about the evils of gun control, who suggests that selective media reporting just plain further fuels our racial divide. Last Saturday, he begins, a man drove his car onto a Seattle freeway that had been closed. Not legally, of course, but by a Black Lives Matter protesting crowd. The driver killed one person and seriously injured another after going the wrong way up a ramp and then around a barricade. Reports claim that police don't believe impairment was a factor, and over the weekend, you probably saw it, news outlets replayed the brutal hit over and over, but there's one thing, says Professor Lott, you won't learn from their coverage. The driver was black, and his victims were white. I would actually say they were red, but that would be politically incorrect. Hey, maybe, if you remember the old joke, I should say they were watermelon. That would be green on the outside, red on the inside. NPR, as we've talked about on this show, tried to link this attack to other car-ramming incidents by what they called right-wing extremists targeting Black Lives Matter protesters, and they quoted a researcher about how these so-called right-wingers were, quote, trying to intimidate the most recent wave of BLM protesters to stop their movement. The trouble is the following. As Professor Lott points out, the driver was a Seattle local named Adawit Kalite. But it almost goes without saying that you'll find scant mention of the driver's ethnicity in mainstream media coverage. You might have more easily learned that Kalite was black by going to the Australia Broadcasting Corporation, and the national media in America certainly don't note that Kalite's two victims were white. But you can also find that out over at the UK's Daily Mail, which actually is where your hosts saw it. Among the few U.S. outlets to actually mention the race of the driver is Heavy.com. The rest of the news media seemingly would just rather have people assume that a white driver attacked two black protesters. But acknowledging the driver's and victim's ethnicity, says Professor Lott, wouldn't advance their narrative of oppression, so apparently it isn't newsworthy. One case, though, he writes, doesn't prove a pattern. It could just be that while the American media know almost everything about this killer, including his name, age, and where he lives, they couldn't find out what race he was. Possibly the foreign news outlets were just lucky to discover that information. And it's possible that the American media might not view his race as essential to the story. But it's their selective reporting about it that shows they do think race is important, but only when it involves certain races. The problem is that it gives readers a biased perspective, inflaming prejudice and creating stereotypes. And that, of course, folks, is the exact intent. Research conducted by the Crime Prevention Research Center, of which I'm president, says John Lott, on all police shootings from 2013 to 15 found that while local news coverage will often mention the race of the officer and the suspect, the national news coverage is much more selective. While evidence indicates that black officers are no less likely to shoot suspects than white officers, local news coverage of black officers shooting black suspects gets picked up by the national press in just 9% of cases. But in contrast, 38%, well over a third of the cases in which local news reported on a white officer shooting a black suspect, got national coverage. This selective coverage creates the belief that white officers are the problem. They're the ones shooting blacks, presumably because white officers treat black suspects differently than they do white ones. Watching the news, he says, you'd never guess that the research found that black officers were just as likely as the white ones to shoot an unarmed black suspect. The media's selective coverage has done real harm, he concludes. It's heightened the racial divide and sown distrust of the police in communities that now need them the most. And what with police sidelined and facing defunding, gun violence, there's a misnomer for you, is rising fast in major cities around the country. Especially, of course, those that are gun-free killing zones. The media, says Lott, similarly seems intent on claiming that mass public shooters are disproportionately white and, of course, right-wing, when nothing could be further from the truth. While 58% of the mass public shooters from 1998 through 2019 were white, excluding people of Middle Eastern descent, about 75% of the total U.S. population was white. Less than proportional. And furthermore, Middle Eastern Arabs made up just 1% of the population, but accounted for 8% of the shooters. Of all the mass shooters, he notes, 72% have no known political affiliation or views, and only 3% are known to be conservative or Republican. Professor Lott doesn't ask it, but I will. I wonder how many of these alleged shooters were actually FBI informants or dupes. Anyway, race and politics, concludes Lott, increasingly divide Americans, and selective media reporting is largely to blame. The media, he says, not President Trump, is fanning the flames of violence. And the destruction and long-term harm that's being done to heavily minority parts of our cities is, in fact, their responsibility. Brandon Smith at AltMarket.com makes this salient observation. Isn't it odd, he writes, that the political left, especially the far left, claims to be so adamantly opposed to racism, yet they're the very first people to make generalizations based on race? Well, maybe it's not so odd, he adds, at least when you consider the history of socialist justice movements and the people who fund them. There is power to be had in creating a race war narrative, and the chaos surrounding such a conflict could be easily exploited, and that's obviously the intent. government. By making everything about race, the political left, he says, is perhaps unwittingly serving the interests of the very wealthy elites they claim to despise, which, of course, is why they're called useful idiots. Back in 2016, he reminds the reader, he pointed out that when the left is ready, they will resort to direct violent action on a larger scale, and they will do so with a clear conscience because, well, arguably because they don't have one, but he says in their minds they're fighting fascism, and obviously they don't have a clue what that means. Ironically, it will be this behavior by leftists that may actually push conservatives towards a more fascist model. In other words, conservatives might decide to fight crazy with even more crazy. This leftist movement, though, is not natural or grassroots. It's completely engineered. We saw this last weekend when a group of well-armed BLM protesters called the NFAC. And no, I'm not going to bother to decode that and have to bleep it again. Marched near Atlanta on July 4th, demanding the destruction of a Confederate monument and deliberately trying to goad what they called white militias into facing off with them. They may not be a legitimate threat, he says, but they are a sign of things to come. And since they seem to have come out of nowhere, that's rather suspicious. First, he said, I would point out that the media is perfectly on board with NFAC and other similar groups, calling them peaceful protesters, whether they are or not. Yet, when conservative militias hold armed demonstrations, the media viciously attacks them and accuses them of being not only right-wing, but inciting violence. When BLM protested the death of George Floyd, the media called it stunning and brave. But when conservatives protested the COVID lockdowns in Michigan that were destroying the economy and their very lives, the media attacked them for spreading the virus. When BLM and Antifa announced they would be busing activists into rural towns, residents organized an armed security response, which caused the protesters to remain peaceful, leave shortly thereafter, and in some cases decide not even to show up. The armed citizens, of course, were demonized and accused of paranoia over a threat that did not exist. And the convenient problem about left-wing extremist groups is that they have no principles or even rules to follow, meaning they operate on lies and manipulation. They don't care about being right. They only care about winning by any means necessary. When Antifa fails or they get caught in the middle of something nefarious, they simply claim they're not a group, but an idea. Therefore, they're not culpable for the actions of a handful of bad apples. And when BLM or Antifa are actually confronted and then don't show up in a rural town to protest because they might have to face organized opposition, the media claims the groups had no plans to protest there anyway. Yeah, he says, it's pretty clear who the left-wing establishment supports and why the battle's not about race, but collectivism versus liberty. Let's wrap up with a few stories I guess I have to call stupid is as stupid does. Item number one from the WAPO, or in this case, I guess we better make sure we know what we're talking about, the Washington Post, which posted an op-ed saying that, quote, both namesakes of the Washington and Lee University perpetrated racial terror. So they said the school should be renamed. But everybody wants to ask the obvious question. What did they overlook? Oh, yeah. Is the Washington Post going to change its name?
Are you stupid or something?
Honestly, as stupid as stupid does.
But wait, there's more. Also courtesy of the Gateway Pundit, according to records released Monday, Plump Jack Winery, a company founded and partly owned by the socialist wannabe tyrant California Governor Gavin Newsom, received a loan worth at least $150,000 to as much as $350,000 from the COVID relief program dubbed Paycheck Protection Program. But the crazed Democrat governor was not too happy when a mere prole asked him about PPP money going to at least one of his businesses. Unfortunately, you can't see the video, but as they put it, Newsom's body language and tone of voice says it all. Quote, you would have to ask the people that are running those businesses. It's in a blind trust, period, full stop, unquote. But there seems to be more to this story. Newsom's winery not only gets bailout bucks, but it's allowed to remain open while others aren't quite so well connected. I guess it's good to be king. I'll close with a question. Have Americans had enough yet?